history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, and you never know what kind of amazing secrets they might be carrying. We're going to hear today about a secret that a Navy pilot had to keep to himself for over a half century, for reasons that I hope will become pretty clear. The idea behind this program is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only do we learn things that we couldn't really learn anywhere else, we are taken on a pretty entertaining ride. And many times, we feel inspired when we get a sense for just how much these brave Americans love our country. If you caught the show last time, you heard two regulars in a pretty special group known as the Old Bold Pilots. If you missed Rod Braswell and the Flying Greek, Steve Pisanos, last time, you can find that interview and about 400 more at hometownheroesradio.com. The Old Bold Pilots meet every Wednesday morning in Oceanside, California. If you ever find yourself in the San Diego area on a Wednesday and you want to shake some of their hands, it's the Denny's Restaurant on the corner of Vista Way and El Camino Real in Oceanside. And you'll know you're in the right place when you see the models of B-17s and P-51s and all kinds of warbirds hanging from the ceiling. Today you'll be hearing some applause, some announcements, and plenty of Denny's dishes in the background, but that'll just remind you that we recorded this while an Old Bold Pilots meeting was underway. The gentleman that we're going to meet today is remarkably humble for somebody who managed to pull off the kind of mission they make movies about, and it certainly was not like anything he ever expected.
90-year-old Royce Williams, originally from South Dakota, a pilot during World War II, and quite some exploits in the Korean War. In fact, if you pick up the January edition of Homeland Magazine, you'll see his smiling face on the cover, the forgotten hero of the forgotten war. And how's this for an introduction? In an exhausting 35-minute dogfight against seven Soviet MiGs, Lieutenant Williams became the only American aviator to single-handedly shoot down four Russian MiGs in a single sortie, a record that most likely will never be broken. Let's go way back before that, before you ever thought about flying or being in the Navy. Your childhood in South Dakota, what was that like growing up during the Great Depression?
Freedom. Your parents didn't worry about where I was, and I had friends, and we would go out from the small town and dam up a little creek and make a swimming pool, or a swimming hole. We played cowboys and Indians, and a lot of excitement and good pals.
Do you remember, even at that young of an age, having any ambitions or thoughts about what you might do in the future?
Oh, yes. Anytime an airplane came by, we were all heads up. Sometimes it would land on a field a mile or so out of town, and we would run all the way to be there. My brother, likewise, who's a retired Marine colonel, naval aviator, but when I was about eight, in our discussions, he wanted to be a naval aviator, I wanted to be a naval aviator, so our goal was set.
Why the Navy for flying as opposed to the old Army Air Corps?
I don't know. It must have been a movie or something.
Got you hooked. And your brother was older or younger?
Year and a half older.
So did he get in first?
Yes, 6 months ahead of me.
What do you remember about December 7th, 1941? Because everybody I've talked to who was alive back then seems to remember something.
I remember exactly. I was roller skating out in front of a store. My dad used his World War I bonus to buy a storefront, and he, being a carpenter and everything else he could do, built a residence behind it. And I was out there, and he said, Royce and Lynn, come on in. And it was the president on announcing Pearl Harbor. And I sat down in front of the radio and listened word by word.
Did that rock your world a little bit?
Oh, yes. Yes, because shortly after that, we signed up.
You both signed up at the same time, you and your brother?
No, I think I signed up first with the Minnesota Guard, and he went on to become a machinist at an outlet of the University of Minnesota at Morris, Minnesota. And then after a short period of that, he signed on.
So you wanted to get over there and do something about what was going on in the world, huh?
I thought I owed it. My dad believed in it. He was a machine gunner in World War I.
Wow. So the family legacy was there. Yes. And as far, I know we want to get to Korea and your incredible story from 1952, but as far as what you did for the rest of World War II, training to become a naval aviator, what are some of the things that stand out for you?
Well, I kind of knew open cockpit biplanes. I went around with the Barnstormer in high school. Used to go to county fairs and sell tickets and put on aerobatic exhibitions.
While you were in high school?
Yeah.
You were doing the aerobatics?
No, I was just going along for the ride.
Oh, okay.
Sell tickets, wipe the airplane down, and fly whenever I could.
That's a good job.
Yeah, it was. And so my early training was in an open cockpit, Navy-built N3N out of a pasture in Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, a lot of academics and athletics in the cadet training program, and the next level was again in open cockpit steerman mm-hmm. out of Memphis, and then gradually into single wing, low, and eventually even retractable landing gear. So I finally got through. As the war was ending, I got extended and extended because they could see that the pipeline of pilots coming in was meeting the need plus.
Mm-hmm.
So I flew the SBD Dauntless as a aviation cadet, and then I went into fighters, Hellcats and Corsairs and Bearcats and on and on.
Mm-hmm. And what about your brother during World War II?
Yes, pretty much the same thing. He did his training out of Yankton, South Dakota initially, and then Minneapolis, Iowa pre-flight. And he chose the Marine route on commissioning, and he was deployed on the Bedoying Strait and in the Battle of Okinawa.
Ah, so he got in at the tail end.
Yes.
But he made it home from the war.
He did, and he stayed on, and in his last assignment as a colonel on Admiral McCain's staff in Hawaii, I relieved him, and he retired the next day and went into the swimming pool business.
Smart man. As for you, when World War II came to an end and you hadn't made it overseas, was there any kind of disappointment on your part that you didn't personally get over there?
Well, there was, but I realized I made the effort, and the rest was Navy program. I fulfilled it.
And I'm sure you didn't want another war. I mean, here there was a war to end all wars, and it's finally over, and America and its allies have won. But just a few years later, Korea crops up. What do you remember about getting deployed during that time period?
Well, I made several deployments right after the war. I was over there on the Princeton and got into Nagasaki shortly after the bomb hit there. I came back and I made regular Navy, so they sent me to the University of Minnesota since I was just a high school grad, and they wanted all their officers to have at least 2 years of college. So they sent me for a year and a half, and I got a four-year degree. Then they sent me on to Monterey School.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, the war was on, and I wondered, why not me? Well, my time came up, and I went. Yes, I was more or less anxious to get in on it. And due course, Navy assignments, I finally got there.
And I'm sorry for bouncing around here, but you mentioned Nagasaki right after the bomb hit.
Yes.
There aren't too many people around today who saw what you saw there, experienced that. What did you see, and what did it do to you?
Well, I knew just about everything I needed to know about it. Seeing kind of magnified it. It was a vast, level area where a lot of manufacturing had been, and the really only thing rising much above ground level were smokestacks that were circular reinforced steel cement as we're standing. But at the north end of the city, there was a rise of hills, and their commercial part of town and a lot of residents were on the other side of this hill, and the pressure from the bomb just went up and over them, and it was maintained, probably got some gamma rays or something, but was not in any way molested.
Mm-hmm. Was it just as a human being to see that there was something capable of that? Was that something that kind of changed your perspective a little?
I think I grew up with it about as early as anybody knew about it. When I was stationed on exchange duty with the Air Force over at Nellis, and they were doing a lot of testing during the time.
Mm.
And I'd be notified that it would be 4 o'clock in the morning, the family would get up and watch the sky light up. I went through Aniwetok at about the time they were doing the testing there and saw all of the ships assemble. And I became a weapons delivery officer later on.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in the nuclear age.
I guess so. And this caption I read earlier, the forgotten hero of the forgotten war, the Korean War, is often forgotten, often overlooked. And you did something in that war that I'm sure you never planned on, that you probably didn't see coming. But November 18th, 1952, what can you tell us about what happened that day?
Well, the Navy carrier force was fully involved in basically operating at the 38th parallel, the division of North and South Korea, and our mission was air to ground, of protecting our troops and destroying enemy trains and trucks and supply lines, tunnels and so forth. And we were not engaged with the MiGs. That was a separate war going on with the Air Force to see who could get the big headlines. But they decided that some of the factories that we should be destroying were beyond our range from there, so they moved a task force of 3 carriers and probably 20-some other ships closer to the Yalu, the river that divides Soviet Union and North Korea. And I was on the first raid pre-dawn and hitting at dawn on a city called Horyong. Our targets were manufacturing sites and warehouses.
And what were you flying?
I was flying a Panther, an F-9F5.
And a lot of people aren't familiar with that plane. They know the ones before it and after it. But what was unique about that plane? What did you appreciate about it?
Well, it was a jet. And we had a jet squadron early, the FJ-1s, VF-51, which was a forerunner of the F-86.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't work out especially well to where the Navy decided to go wholly into the jets. But then as time moved on, we did, and the Panther was one of the very first of a line of jet aircraft. I was originally assigned to a Corsair squadron, being qualified in it, but when I saw the Panthers over there, I learned the name of the commanding officer. It was a guy I knew back at the University of Minnesota. So I sought his help, and he got me transferred to his squadron.
So your airspeed and your horsepower increased a little bit, going from the prop to the jet. And getting back to November of 1952, so you're flying this F-9F. That's a jet aircraft. But the Soviets, of course, have the MiG fighters in the air as well. Pick it up where you left off before I interrupted you.
Well, I came back, and they always maintain a combat air patrol over the task force. Well, I had had a cold, and I had fewer flights recently, so I was tabbed to take the next one. I went as a part of a 4-plane Panther flight, and the weather was lousy, 400 feet base of the clouds. Terrible winds and driving snow. We catapult launched off the Oriskany, our carrier, and formed up below the clouds, climbed through them, and on top we saw the incoming contrails of a warning, a heads up, that we'd gotten from our combat information center that there were bogies, unidentified aircraft, inbound. And so when we popped through the clouds, we saw them. I saw them anyway.
And within minutes, he would be outnumbered and overmatched. But clearly, he lived to tell the story, a story that had to be kept under wraps for more than 50 years. We'll explain when we come back. For photos and a link to that magazine article you heard me mention, head on over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we'll be right back after this. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting RVCountry.com. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This February,
when the Messiah comes, Rome will be nothing.
Prepare to witness the miracle that changed the world forever.
The Nazarene city rise again after 3 days. We will lose peace and order if it's true.
Through the eyes of a non-believer. Risen, starring Joseph Fiennes.
The tomb is sealed, guarded with your life.
The most important manhunt in history.
The body has vanished.
His tomb is empty.
Was just beginning.
No more lies. What happened to the body?
The ropes, they just exploded.
Risen.
Where does he go?
You tell me.
You're looking for something you'll never find.
Open your heart and see.
Risen. Rated PG-13. Maybe inappropriate for children under 13. Now playing. For tickets and showtimes, go to risen-movie.com.
With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV Country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly-and-buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV.
It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV Country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, hanging out again with the old bold pilots in Oceanside, California. Over the weeks ahead, you'll hear from veterans in Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada, California. You'll hear some pretty remarkable coincidences and some little-known history that'll be in store for us. But this time, a second straight episode from that San Diego area restaurant where a group of former military aviators meets every week to share stories. Until the last decade or so, Royce Williams was not authorized to share the story of what happened on November 18th, 1952. The South Dakota native had become a pilot during World War II. Now the Korean War was pressing on, but the one thing to be avoided at all costs was a direct war with the Soviet Union. Flying an F-9F-5 Panther, that's an early jet fighter, off the aircraft carrier USS Oriskany, he took off with 3 other planes in windy, snowy, blinding conditions as they were to provide a combat air patrol above their task force in the Sea of Japan. When they broke through the clouds, they spotted the contrails of 7 Soviet fighter jets. We'll pick it up right there with 90-year-old retired Navy fighter pilot Royce Williams.
At that point, the flight leader, who was senior to me, had a problem with his airplane, and he was told to take his wingman and remain over the task force. And I took the lead of the flight with my wingman, a guy I had never flown with before, and pursued the, as they flew over the top of me, and they were at extreme altitude and all giving contrails, that smoke trail behind them, cloud trail. I identified them as MiGs, and they said, that's your target. When they flew over me, they reversed course and headed north. So I flew in that direction, getting further and further behind them, but climbing. And when they got to 26,000 feet, they split in two groups, 103 and 104, and turned in different directions, either to bracket me or decide to go and land or something. But I lost sight of them at that point. And so did the radar operator. So they gave me a command to come back and establish a barricade between the last sighting and the location of the task force. And in that turn, there came four of them in, and they were all shooting at us. And they missed, and as they went by, I kicked in a lot of rudder and wrapped the airplane around and dropped in behind their number four airplane. And with a short burst, he dropped out of the formation and started going down. I didn't know it right then, but my wingman left me and pursued the airplane going down.
Mm-hmm.
The others climbed in an amazing way, showing off their greater capability than anything I had.
So I want to understand here. At this point, your wingman has chased the other guy. You've already shot down one of the seven, but now you're up there one on six, and you just said their capability for the MiG was greater than your Panther. So you're one on six with an airplane that's inferior to theirs.
That's correct.
Did that hit you at the time, that the odds were not in your favor?
Well, I didn't plan on this. It was a complete surprise. And I just went on gut tuition and training, and I knew I was in the fight. I was actually told by the controller, do not engage, and I reported that we are engaged. I couldn't just turn tail and run. It wasn't my job, for one thing, and besides that, I probably for sure would have been shot down. So I pursued these three that I already had in sight, and they went high above me and then reversed and came in head on. And so I fired at the first one coming in, and he was shooting way out of range, and I fired where it was about in range, and he broke off, but his wingman came in, and I think I nailed him. He just came straight in and non-maneuvering and passed underneath me. And from then on, they were not formation. They were just taking their turns of the five airplanes left now and attacking. And my job was, I was a fighter pilot, and I knew how to maneuver against a lesser airplane. But the roles had been reversed, and I was now the target with superior numbers and better airplanes coming against me. So I was in a turning defensive fight. And they came in one after another, and I would just do what I could to spoil their aim. As they'd fly by, they did what they should have done, to put their nose up and just pull up, and I would not have the capability to do that with my plane to chase them. But in some cases, they made a mistake, and they went out ahead of me and turned flat, in which case I wrapped the airplane around and was able to get shots at them.
Had you ever had any kind of experience like this before?
Training. But my training was pretty much the role that they were playing against an adversary that was probably a multi-engine, slower or something like that. And I was in a more maneuverable airplane and kind of doing what these guys were doing now. But I was a reverse role.
So slowly but surely, over more than 30 minutes, you're picking off one plane at a time. 35 minutes engaged with seven MiGs in this dogfight. How long did it feel like? Did it feel like longer than 35 minutes?
No, the time was sort of compressed. I was just busy, and there was no time to just look around. I was doing a lot of looking, but then I'd see a guy on my tail, and I had to counter him, and then the next guy, and just went on and on until I finally I'd shot down another new, because I could see the parts fly off him, and I had to pull the airplane around to avoid hitting pieces of the airplane. Then I had another one smoking, and I was trying to pursue him when I saw a MiG come in on my tail, and then trying to avoid him, he hit me with a 37 millimeter right on a vital part of the airplane and went through the wing and into the accessory section of the engine, and it just wiped out. I had the cables to the rudder were shot away, and all the hydraulics were gone, and I basically just had an elevator as the control available to me. And he settled in behind me. I was out of ammunition at this point anyway.
So you're out of ammunition, and your plane's not working right.
Right. It was way out of trim and hard to fly. So I was using two hands on the control stick and heading toward the clouds. And this guy settled in right behind me at a perfect firing range. And he was just shooting, and I could see both the 23mm and the 37 fly over me and under me as I was pushing over and pulling back and upsetting his aim. So he wasn't getting to me, and I got in the clouds and he lost sight of me. And I headed back to the task force.
And you're describing this story. You lived it. You've told this story a few times. Maybe it's not
recently, because I was not permitted to talk about it. So 50-some years went by before I told anybody, and that included my brother or my wife or anyone.
Because this engagement was not to have occurred between American fighters and Soviet fighters?
Well, I suppose that was part of it, but I was told it was because this was the first engagement of a new authority and capability, NSA. Everybody knows it today, but this was its first operational mission, and it was aboard a cruiser, the Helena, right off Vladivostok, and with their sophistication and language capability, they had these guys from the time they took off from the field, the Soviet Army Air Force, and through the engagement, and they said until the remnant came back. And so they didn't want to disclose that we had something new in this capability.
Mm-hmm. So that was the first operational mission?
For the NSA operational group. The people that were on the special mission on this cruiser that were monitoring the Soviets.
Got it.
And they had the total picture of what happened. Mm-hmm. And they're the only reason that I knew how many airplanes I shot down. Other than that, I'd see hits and that sort of thing, but I didn't know how many actually were shot down.
You're just trying to survive. You're not keeping score.
That's right. So I didn't know. I have flash remembrances of a lot of it that all pales in, but later on after the Cold War, the Soviets, now the Russians, released the information, and I have the names of the four Soviet pilots that were shot down.
Is that a sobering thought to look at those names?
Yes, yes it is. Yeah,
but if those four weren't shot down, you would have been, in almost certainty, right? And you probably should have been.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'd say if God wasn't on my side, I'd be in the bottom of the ocean off Vladivostok.
Well, and really, I mean, we think about that. Here you've got, you know, you're outnumbered 7-1. They've got better airplanes. And then your plane is disabled and out of ammunition, and there's a guy right on your tail. In those moments, did you think that was it? Did you think there was any way you were going to escape that and survive?
Thinking is an odd thing to say, but I was just busy doing what I was doing, and I don't know, I suppose hope was built in, but I was just totally involved in doing the best I could. And I probably had an adrenaline high and shock after I landed, which was a feat in itself. But then I was talking to the chaplain later toward evening, and that's about the time it set in.
I imagine so, and you said something a moment ago that you had God on your side, and maybe the landing is one of these moments, but what are the moments along that way where you look back and say, yeah, God must have been looking out for me?
There's no doubt. It's sort of like David and seven Goliaths.
Haven't heard that version.
And we haven't heard the whole story just yet. He wouldn't be talking to us today if he didn't find a way to land that crippled fighter jet. He'll walk us through that when we come back, not to mention a later landing during the Vietnam War that no one else had been able to pull off, one that helped identify and correct a major malfunction. For pictures and a link to a great article about Royce Williams from Homeland Magazine, go to hometownheroesradio.com or pull up Facebook and just type in Hometown Heroes Radio. We'll get the rest of his story right after this.
If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
If you've spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
Veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with a record-setting Navy fighter pilot. We'll hear him explain the unprecedented part in a bit. 90-year-old Royce Williams of Escondido, California, one of the old, bold pilots who gather every Wednesday morning to share their memories. Mr. Williams' memories go all the way back to Wilmot, South Dakota. He served nearly 40 years in the Navy, retiring with the prestigious rank of captain, and his decorations include the Silver Star, awarded for the events of November 18, 1952. When he succeeded against ridiculous odds in a major mismatch, a dogfight in which he ended up alone in the skies over the Sea of Japan against 7 Soviet MiG fighters. sort of like David and seven Goliaths, as he quipped before we left off. He shot down four of them, but perhaps more impressively, he survived even after he ran out of ammunition and had his plane damaged extensively when one of those MiGs scored a hit on his F-9F-5 Panther. He wasn't allowed to discuss it at all for over a half century because of the potential far-reaching implications of an American-Soviet engagement, and also because of the secret surveillance being carried out by the fledgling National Security Agency, the NSA. And no one would have ever heard the story quite like this if he hadn't survived a very dangerous high-speed crash landing.
About the landing, you said you had the elevator and that was it. You've got no rudder. Your plane is damaged. Obviously, you're out of ammunition. You can't defend yourself. Where did you have to bring it down, and how did that all unfold?
Well, I was now being guided to the task force by the Combat Information Center controller, and I, on my own, flew on down. I knew the base of the clouds were 400 feet, so I just settled down under it. And I was thinking all along that something might just really go wrong and I'm going to have to eject out of the airplane. But once I got below 1,200 feet, I didn't have the capability to eject safely anymore. So I was pretty much committed, either that or ditch the airplane. But in the terrible storm that was going on, I would not have survived that. Besides, this was November and the temperature of the water was so low. Even though I was in an immersion suit, I probably wouldn't survive more than 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So I was committed, and I had to use emergency systems to get the tail hook down and the landing gear down. And I didn't know what speed I could fly at, so I was testing it while I had time. And I found that below 170 knots, that's probably about 190 miles an hour, the airplane would stall, and I had to come in hot, much faster than we normally do. But I couldn't guide the airplane to be exacting as required for a carrier landing. Incidentally, I was shot at by our own ships when I came in because they were at ready to fight. There was the battle was on for them, and I hadn't been identified as a friendly, but that was brief.
Just what you need after everything you've been through, seven MiGs shooting at you, and then your guys are shooting at you.
Yeah. And I couldn't line up with the carrier. I got pointed at it when it was into the wind, but I couldn't. This was a straight deck before we went to angle decks.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to line up right on down the deck, and I couldn't do it. I could aim at the airplane, but I probably would have just, if I hit the airplane, the deck at all, probably bounced off and gone over the side. But the commanding officer of the ship at the last moment turned it and lined it up with me, and I ended up with more or less a normal landing.
More or less a normal landing after all that.
Yeah.
And then you said afterwards is when it really sank in for you. Have you ever met another pilot who shot down four Russian planes in a day?
There aren't any American pilots who have shot down four jets ever on one mission.
You're the only one?
Only one. The Air Force, in its total commitment to fighting the MiGs with an F-86 Sabre, equal or better airplane in some regards. And the most they ever shot down in one mission was two. And this is after they've been fighting him and into all kinds of experience. And there were six of them that got two in one mission out of all that. And it wasn't their first mission by far.
So here, you're the only pilot that's ever done what you've done, but you have to keep it a secret for a half century. Was that difficult or no big deal for you?
I learned to live with it. And it was initially because in our squadron, we have camaraderie and so forth, and we're all busy fighting the war, and we're going back to doing the defense of our troops and so forth. And I never talked about it because when I was cautioned not to say what I knew, the only way I could avoid it was just don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't. You know, and it was kind of hard being in there, it being sort of a centerpiece of our deployment, and hush, hush. You know, people kind of look at me strangely and say, I guess, you know, why is he so closed-mouthed?
And how long did you stay in the Navy?
Well, I went on a physical disability retirement in 1970, late 75, almost 76. And then I got recalled. I eventually got my regular retirement in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
It was 1942, stint with Minnesota Guard. And then from 43 to to 80 in the Navy. And then after I retired, I got recalled one more time to go out as a Commodore of a task force for training.
During the Vietnam War, what were you up to?
I was a wing commander on the Kitty Hawk. I was flying F-4 Phantoms and A-4 Skyhawks.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot of interesting experiences there as well. And the second tour, because of injuries and stuff I had from a plane crash one time, they limited me from some of the medications they were authorized. And going from 5.5 grains of thyroid a day down to none, I was losing my hair and tired. And when they realized the mistake and that, they sent me orders that you're authorized for command at sea, in combat, in naval aircraft, in command, but not at the actual controls.
Mm.
So I got myself in the school for naval flight officers and went back as a wing commander in the back seat.
When's the last time you flew?
Well, I haven't done any real active flying since being relieved as the wing commander. And I would fly with others. When I was chief of staff comm for Westpac, we had a lot of commanders that would come on up and fly missions out of Atsugi, Japan, and I would fly along with them as co-pilot and for my own amazement, mostly.
Mm-hmm. You nonchalantly mentioned injuries from a plane crash. Mm-hmm. Most people don't have that experience. Have you had more than one of those experiences, or what's the one you're referring to?
No, the only one that I really crashed, I've had some very interesting. I brought one airplane back with Phantom with both engines on fire, and loss of power. I had to land an afterburner, which was only one of the kind. But the Phantom was flown around the world by the British and the Aussies and a lot of Americans, and they'd lost 16 airplanes in a row to a double engine fire, and here it happened to me. But they had always bailed out. I had my backseater eject, but I brought the airplane back, and they found out what caused it and corrected it, and we had no more of that.
And what were the extent of your injuries?
Well, I have 11 vertebrae that aren't right.
Only 11?
Yeah.
So you had your backseater, as you said, eject.
Yes.
You stayed with the airplane just because you thought, hey, if anyone can pull this off, I can, or what?
No, it was because my training... As long as it's flying and I'm able to command it, I stayed with it. I still had the option. If something suddenly happened, I could eject.
Mm-hmm.
But I flew to board, and I didn't want it endangering hospitals and schools and all of that. So I just drove it till I got back aboard the base.
So you started flying as a pilot in World War II, Korea, the Cold War, the Vietnam War. In all that time, did you have a favorite aircraft you flew?
I did. Much the propeller airplane, the F-8 Bearcat. It had so much power that it was stunning. And then the next thing was in the jets with afterburners. And one of the most exciting airplanes I flew was the F-8 Crusader.
And another question that comes to mind in all that time, and you made reference to growing up in the nuclear age, you're there at Nagasaki after that impact. You're around Nevada when they're testing bombs and out in the Pacific when they're testing. And then you said that later on you had to deal with that in some of your deployments, some of the aircraft that you were involved with. In light of that, do you have some insight that most of us don't as far as how close we came to nuclear weaponry being deployed again?
Well, there were an awful lot of people that were deployed in the same mission, and I suppose the closest we really came to it was the Cuban incident.
Any specific knowledge of that you're aware of?
Well, I was on the East Coast. I was serving in Washington for the Navy, had a promotion plans at the time. And then I went to squadron command of VF-33 on the Enterprise, who were a part of the activities during the Cuban incident.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the pilots had taken part in that.
Is it somewhat amazing to you that we haven't gotten to that point?
Yes.
I guess another thing comes to mind, that the perspective that you have on all these conflicts and the men that you served with through parts of 5 different decades in the Navy, what are you most proud of and what are you most thankful for?
Well, I had my sights set on this thing as a kid. It's what I wanted to do, and I guess I'm pretty happy that I did it.
Well, thank you for serving our country, sir. Thank you for telling us a story that wasn't told for a long time and that only you can tell. I got to ask you about this group here, the Old Bold Pilots. How long have you been coming here, and what do you get out of it?
I guess I've been about 4 or 5 years. It was banded well before that. I was invited by another well-known Navy pilot, T.R. Schwartz, to come over here about the time it first began. But I ignored that for a lot of years, and then finally I got involved with the same guys at a couple of other groups where we meet on a regular basis, the Quiet Birdmen and Bagels and Bologna. And through them I got invited over here.
And I imagine you hear something different every time?
Well, there are a lot of good stories out there.
What impresses you? What about these gentlemen gets you excited to come?
Well, I guess the legacy, we've all been pretty much through the same thing, and we share it knowing that, but not getting excited about it.
Mm-hmm. Last thing for you. In light of everything you've experienced, and you've seen the world at some very tense moments, is there anything that, as we look ahead and try to learn lessons from our past, that with all your insight and personal experience, you would like to pass on?
I've seen an awfully lot of change from a kid on the prairie in Dakotas where it was pretty much horse and buggy, especially in the wintertime, to where we have all this electronic stuff, including warfare now. It hasn't changed the world much. There are always wars. There's always danger. It's fought differently. It's just as dangerous. And we depend on good leadership. We're in a horse race for a new president, and I hope we get a good one.
Don't we all? That's Royce Williams, 90 years old. And also, one thing that you'll find in the magazine article that I have linked at hometownheroesradio.com that Royce didn't get to in this interview is that about a month after that dogfight with the MiGs, he was summoned to meet with President-elect Dwight Eisenhower and explain what he had observed about those Soviet fighters. Larger-than-life generals Mark Clark and Omar Bradley were there too, and you'll find out what Royce regrets about one mundane choice he made that day. So check that out at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And really, I know there are a ton of great tourist attractions around San Diego, even some incredible military-themed ones. But what better way to engage with history than to meet some of the guys who lived through it, hear their stories, shake their hands, thank them for their service to our country? The Old Bold Pilots are there at Oceanside every Wednesday morning at 7 at Denny's on the corner of Vista Way and El Camino Real. Time to wrap this one up, but I hope you can join us again for the next installment of Hometown Heroes. Until then, I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.